Hello and welcome to another episode of the IAAF Inside Athletics podcast, where we bring you the best and brightest, the weird and the wonderful of all things track and field. We have a huge show for you today. I'm joined by Bob Ramsack and Michelle Sammet, and we go through a review of the IAAF World Indoor Tour. We talk about some of the world records on the road by Sifan Hassan and Julian Wonders. We also look ahead to the NCAA Indoor Championships, and we look ahead to the European Indoor Championships because there's loads of talking points there. And finally, today's guest star, fresh out of the Big Brother House USA, is double world indoor champion Lolo Jones. Stay tuned, guys. Today's a really exciting one. Okay, guys, so on today's episode, I've been joined by Michelle Sammet.
Hello.
And Bob Ramsack.
Good day.
So we've got, representing all corners of Europe today, Bob from Slovenia via the USA.
Ljubljana.
Ljubljana, yeah. And then Michelle representing Frankfurt-ish.
Germany. Well, Germany, all the way. Welcome to my home country.
Yeah, we're recording this from Dusseldorf. The World Indoor Tour has just finished, and there's a lot to talk about. So let's start with that then. So we are in Dusseldorf. We saw a great ending to the meet last night with a few really standout performances. So let's start with your highlights just from Dusseldorf anyway.
Just from Dusseldorf? Well, it's hard to see past Jakob Ingebrigtsen upsetting Samuel Teixeira in the 1500. Spoke to him afterwards and he was saying, of course, now that he's beaten the world record holder, the world record is on his mind. He doesn't think that he will break it this year, maybe not next year, but he said it's by running against the best in the world, i.e. Samuel Teixeira, he's definitely building up to challenging for senior world record eventually.
You know what I was curious about is I heard Philip, his older brother, the middle brother, saying afterwards, because he came third, I think, talking about how hard indoors was. And then that kind of got me thinking. I was like, he's obviously bigger than Jakob. Is that just how much does the height thing play in indoors? When we go outdoors, will it be a different ball game with Jakob and Philip?
It's an interesting one because in Boston at the World Indoor Tour meeting, we were talking about that in the press conference. And Edward Cheserek, who of course is very accomplished indoors as well, said he loves the indoors because he's tiny. So he says he likes the tight bends. And for a lot of the guys that are a bit taller, that are a bit broader, they do struggle on the tight bends.
Yeah. Jakob's not small per se. I just love watching how composed and confident he is when he runs. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to forget that he's just 18 years old. Mm-hmm. That's just mind-boggling to me.
I mean, you spoke to him ahead of the race and you spoke to him about the world record, right?
Yeah, and afterward. Well, it was Philip who said, I asked him, did you guys watch the record the other night? And he said, no, they didn't watch, but they did notice it. And Philip said, yeah, it was fast. But Jakob didn't seem that impressed. He said, yeah, it was great. It was a fast time. But he seemed to think the event hasn't changed that much, just mm-hmm. from shaving a couple hundredths from the previous world record. And he also said last night after the race, very calmly, said, no, I don't think I'll be able to break it this year because I haven't worked towards that. But he certainly wasn't discounting the fact that it's not something that's he's certainly capable of doing.
So. Yeah, I think that's the... What's interesting is obviously Jakob had a great outdoors last year, winning two senior European titles. Obviously, when you go to the world stage, it's a whole different ball game. And, you know, I'm not really sure. I mean, the long game here is Doha, end of the year. And I honestly could not call whether he'll go out in the semi-finals or whether he'd win gold. I just have no idea.
Well, I think the most exciting thing about all of it, because there was a bit of confusion last night on social media, it was doing my head in a bit, was the fact that he set a world under 20 record and people were saying, well, surely Teixeira's world record is a world under 20 record. But of course, Teixeira is turning 20 later this year. I think his birthday is in October. So he's not eligible for the under 20 age group anymore. But he's still just 19 at the moment and he's turning 20 this year. Yeah. And there is Jakob Ingebrigtsen with his 18 years turning 19 this year, which means we have incredible talent, both still super young, and we'll probably have them in the sport for a very long time. And it's great to see a young rivalry building up like that. And of course, the more accomplished, more experienced guys going towards the outdoor season, racing against these guys.
I think,
these guys really are redefining, I think, what the 1500 can be.
Mm-hmm.
And the focus was on Jacob last night, but let's remember that Tefera just ran a world record just 4 days earlier. He was probably a little tired. He looked tired towards the end.
I was going to say that as well.
So we need to bear
And he was tired in Birmingham in the mix zone. He got a lot of flack on Twitter for not showing enough of a jubilant reaction after he got the world record. That boy was spent. He had nothing left. He was vomiting, throwing up in the mix zone. Like, he literally could barely walk. You just ran a world record. You saw Wade van Niekerk, right?
Exactly.
In Beijing and Rio. When he's run a world record, you've pushed your body to the absolute limit.
Yeah.
What makes you think that, you know, it's not like the sprints when, like a 100-meter sprint where, you know,
brush it off and celebrate and do three laps of honour, which is the furthest sprinter has run.
But when you see these athletes break their national records, area records, like Laura Muir, she's on the floor for about 5 minutes after she finishes a race. Like, that is a real endurance reaction to this kind of thing. And he's so young as well. Like, he has a lot of time to, you know, become more accustomed to, I don't know, celebration or whatever. But I think going on from that, it's great to see Tefera. And, you know, before that race, people were building up Gudelcha because he was 0.01 off the mile world record in the Millrose Games. And again, he's super young as well. And then you've got throwing Salomon Berega. I know he's more 5K, but again, like, these are incredible athletes.
And I think it's been interesting to watch Samuel Tefera over the course of this indoor season because, I mean, we were at a lot of the meets. I was in Karlsruhe, in Toron, here in Dusseldorf, and actually seeing how he gets more accustomed to the other people on the circuit. I mean, we've just heard the lovely story of him carrying Katarina Stefanidi's luggage after his world record race in Birmingham here in Dusseldorf, and he's warming up to people as well. And as you said, we mustn't forget how young he is.
Mm-hmm.
There's language barriers. It's completely different cultures. It's different temperatures. He was super cold the other day coming out the arena because they're just not used to this. So I think it's by being on the circuit, by being around of all the other people and seeing how to get on. I've already seen over the course of the last 4 weeks a massive growth in him, and I think that's really exciting. Mm-hmm. Moving to the outdoor season.
Yeah, I think generally this is it's a culture shock. Props to him anyway, and well done to his world record.
I'd like to see Ethiopia field a 4x1 mile relay team somewhere.
Touchy subject.
No, but definitely, yeah.
I mean, yeah, they could put in a mean team.
Against the Ingebrigtsen brothers, for starters.
Maybe it's a 3x mile. Oh my god.
I'd actually be so down to see that.
I'll put it on. Get the summer backyard open up. Do a few laps. I'll sort it out, don't worry.
Who would you put your money on?
I'm not a gambling man, but if I were forced to be, I'd probably go to Ethiopia at the moment.
I think I'd be seeing Ethiopia too. Anyways, okay, moving away from middle distances. On the women's side of things during the World Indoor Tour, what have been your highlights so far? I mean, no, what have been your highlights? Because the tour has ended.
I like the women's pole vault. I liked how unpredictable it was.
Yeah.
Angelika Sidorova coming away with a tour win yesterday. She's been very consistent. Katarina Stefanidi, of course, always pretty consistent, which I think quite a few people were surprised about yesterday, that she only managed to finish third in the final. But looking at the top three in the tour standings, Sidorova, Nicoleta Kyriakopoulou and Katarina Stefanidi, to have a great rematch at Europeans next week.
Mm-hmm. Throw in the likes of Bradshaw, who won the Birmingham World Indoor Tour with 4.481. It's going to be a great competition. I also think it's interesting, you know, Stefanidi, she's spoken a lot about the difference between indoor and outdoor vaulting, and it's almost like a different event slightly, with and it varies from meet to meet, because sometimes the runway is raised, sometimes it isn't, and this plays a huge part in the result of that actual meeting. So you can be like, oh wow, Stefanidi's in great form, and the next meet she jumps 460, and you're like, I don't understand. So that kind of explains the variance of indoor vaulting. But, you know, when you go outdoor, it's more of a, level playing field. I guess when you're in the big stadium Diamond Leagues, it's all fairly similar.
It is, but then of course you have other factors like wind, weather play in, and then winds are turning. It depends on the stadium. Sometimes an athlete prefers headwinds, or there's like it's a very, very complex event. And I think it's been interesting for us because we've learned a lot about the pole vault this indoor season. Both from the men and the women. We've had a lot of talks over breakfast, lunch, dinner, of learning all sorts of new things. And I mean, Holly Bradshaw's done actually something really good, which I don't know whether you've seen, but she's taken to Twitter to try and explain her event a bit more, because she got frustrated by commentators not explaining things correctly and said, well, if you're not asking, here are the main things to look at. And it's explaining about poles, it's explaining about run-ups, it's explaining about standards and so forth. And I think more athletes should actually do that, because although we work in the sport, we don't know every event inside out and we don't know all the technicalities. So I think it's actually really, really good to see athletes taking to a public domain and actually explaining their event a bit better.
Yeah, my favourite thing from that, she mentioned how your hip height over the bar does not mean that you can get over the bar, clear a bar of that height. And I was like, oh, I didn't really think about it before. But yeah, because sometimes you see these people clearance and they go miles over and the commentator's like, wow, they've got loads more room there. And then she's like, no, that's not the case, because you need to get your whole body over that height. And yeah, go to her Twitter feed and check that out, because yeah, there was some interesting lessons. On the sprint side of things, in the women's, we had Eva Swoboda of Poland. She seems to be back this year with a bang. She had a successful year a few years ago, I feel, when she kind of first burst on the scene.
I think she was just taking things more seriously, is what I gathered from some colleagues in Poland.
Okay.
Less distraction this year. She's really going full force with athletics now. It did show.
Yeah.
She's running a lot better. She looks stronger. She's also more confident.
She was in Karlsruhe. Her reaction after the heat when she ran that 7:08, she was absolutely over the moon, because she didn't expect to run that well in her first race of the season. And she's been incredibly consistent. Of course, won the Tour, lost to Marie-José Talou yesterday in Düsseldorf, who set the world lead of 7:02. But Svoboda has really been one of the most consistent performers of this indoor tour. And as you mentioned, she had a great year, I think 2016 it was, when she had...
I think it was around then, yeah.
Even 15, 17. She's won European medals indoors as well. But she was saying, really, that, like you said, A, she's been taking things more seriously, but also she's grown more confident. She's got more used to the fact that, yes, you are travelling a lot, you are going around the circuit.
She's done a lot of races as well.
She has, because a lot of times in those sprints, we do actually have heats in the World Indoor Tour events as well, which some other events don't have. So actually, it has probably prepared her quite well for the European indoors next week.
Yeah, she's been really, really consistent, as you say. But it was really, really nice to see, because, you know, they've been running decent times, like 7:08, 7:10, around that area. But then to see Talou come out last night and just obliterate that world lead. Like, she originally it was 7:01, and we were all like, ah! But then, yeah, 7:02, still pretty amazing. And her reaction was brilliant as well. She basically fell on the ground in disbelief.
It was the same thing, and I was really happy to see that, because I spoke to her in Turun when she kicked off her season. She basically said she was here to do four races this winter to really work on her start and on her finish, and in between, whatever happens. And you could see whatever she was working on worked. She was very consistent. I'm just looking at here. All of her races were 7:15, 7:16, 7:15, 7:15, 7:22, 7:15, 7:14. You know, long heats. And she was just due for something really good last night. And she also, she fell to the ground. She was so thrilled with that. And I think that bodes really well for her looking ahead. Because again, she said, this is what it's all about. Looking towards Doha as a double medalist.
And I think that's the key thing. We've heard it from so many athletes on this circuit that, yes, the indoor season's important. It's also almost a reward for a lot of athletes who've been putting themselves through grueling winter training, and you don't really get any instant feedback in where you are. You don't know how you're doing. And that's why the indoor season is so important, because you might have completely messed up your training and actually things aren't going well at all. And that's why the indoor season is such an important marker. And then coming out, showing that you are really in great shape, that you have worked on the right things, and even treating for certain events, competition is the best training. And so using that as a building block for what's going to be a long but really kind of exciting season with the events that we have building up, I think is really good to see how a lot of athletes have taken to that.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what Andy Pozzi was saying to us in the lead up to Düsseldorf, because he was talking about how the idea of doing a long, hard winter of training and then just having nowhere to, no comparison to see where you're at to kind of measure, you know, gauge what's going on with you. And, you know, he originally ruled out doing an indoor season because of an injury, but then things cleared up and then he was just like, he just wanted to see where he was at. And that, you know, it's such a long season this year. You know, we finish in late September, early October. So, you know, I don't blame some of these athletes wanting to have a little break point and just, you know, get the opportunity to win some medals at the Europeans.
At the same time, we do hear a lot about the fact that it's a long season with the world champs about a month later than they usually are.
Mm-hmm.
But some athletes have also said they don't mind.
Yeah, a lot.
Talking to Juan Miguel Echevarria, he doesn't care. The more the merrier. He's ready to keep going.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Caterina Stefanidi told us last year it was really only a couple more weeks in extension to what she competed last year.
If that, I think, because she was at the Continental Cup, right? And yeah. I think she said it would be another 2 weeks and then she'd be done in the same time in 2019. So, you know, I think it's a mindset. I think that a lot of athletes have, you know, just been like, okay, fine, this is how it is this year. And, you know, we're pretending like this is the first time this has ever happened. The Sydney Olympics, it was even later than that, I think. It was in October, the athletics at the Sydney Olympics. So, yeah, I think aside from all that, can we talk about the men's high jump?
You're a fan.
I literally am.
Ben's a fanboy.
I am a complete convert of Naoto Tobi of Japan. He, when he first came out in Karlsruhe and jumped 2:35, I was like, yes. And he's such a cool guy as well. He's just so nice, so sweet, and it's just nice to see breakout stars. You know what I mean? I mean, okay, 2:35. It's not like amazing, but I think, you know, that can win medals, 2:35 outdoors, and I can't remember what his best was. I think his best indoors was like 2:29 or something
like that. He really, really improved in Karlsruhe. And you know what I also like? He celebrates very entertainingly. Like, you can really see on his face how much it means to him. And just yesterday in Düsseldorf, again, we saw him and the Chinese Wang really go against each other. And they've been pushing each other throughout this season. They both jumped well in Karlsruhe as well.
Yep.
And they cheer for each other and they support each other. And it's just nice, as you said, to see some new faces in this event as well.
The bottom line for me, that it was just really entertaining to watch.
Yeah.
Everybody was enjoying it. The jumpers were enjoying it. Even with the delays yesterday, the high jump actually saved that meeting.
Yeah.
Because with those delays.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had a fun event to watch.
Yeah.
And they were really enjoying themselves.
Yeah, I think it's exciting, again, looking ahead to Doha, but like the Asian men's high jump, because we've got the Asian Championships, which is the test event for Doha, happening in April, I believe.
It's mid-April, or I think we're on the 20th or 21st.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that'll give us a few more indications.
World Championships in Doha. We have World Indoor Championships in Nanjing, like next year in China, which, of course, he has now the wild card, Tobi.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Because he's just won the World Indoor Tour. And then we have Tokyo. So for these guys, they'll all be in their backyard jumping. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited about the next 24 months.
Yeah, no, it's going to be really, really exciting. With the likes of Mutaz being, obviously, Asian as well. And then the Syrian high jumper, his name escapes me, is it Ghazal?
He won a medal. Edin Ghazal.
Yeah,
yes.
He won a medal in London as well. So, you know, they've got really, really strong competition there. Yeah. So, it's nice to see an event thriving in a specific area.
Yeah.
Looking forward to that come the summer. It's going to be really exciting.
Okay. I want to give a special shout out to Nathan Strother.
Oh, yeah.
Because he had his first full kind of season on the pro circuit indoors here. We spoke with him in Karlsruhe quite a bit, or was it in Turin? I think it was in Turin quite a bit. Mm-hmm. He raced in Boston and won there. We saw him in Turin and he was kind of doing his own thing. And he said, well, he had a few meets down that he wanted to race and just see how he gets on, getting used to racing indoors quite a bit, and he was just taking it round by round, and then suddenly he's finding himself in this World Indoor Tour final against Pavel Maslak. And it was that event really was down to this particular race, because it was whoever wins gets the World Indoor Tour title. And the way he ran that race yesterday was so mature, was really waiting until the right moment. And to challenge someone like Maslak, who's so accomplished indoors, I was just really impressed. And I just think that deserves a mention.
I was impressed with him as well. The times aren't quite as fast as the world leader thing, but you have to bear in mind, this is a whole process here. There's a lot of travel involved. You're on the road a lot, and that's not easy. Mm-hmm. It's not easy for us. I can't imagine what it's like for athletes. You know, and I also pointed out, I spoke to him briefly after his race, and even though he didn't outright win Torun, he was never beaten to the line this year, because they ran separate sections, and Maslak won one section, was a little bit faster.
Oh, okay.
But nobody actually beat Strother this year.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Which has to be a confidence boost for him, especially coming in an event that is so strong in the States. So this will be a nice confidence boost for him.
Yeah, yeah.
As they approach the U.S. Trials next summer.
Yeah, and he's super young, and it's, again, just nice to see new faces. In the men's 400 metres, though, Carsten Vorholm has also been pretty impressive this season. He's run mid-45 indoors, which we all know is really, really, really fast indoors.
Yeah, I've just looked it up because we literally just this very second saw on his Instagram that he's actually confirmed he is racing the 400 at the European Indoor Champs. If you have a chance, go on his Instagram because it's a very funny post.
Yeah.
But his time of 45:56 is ranking him number 5 in the world at the moment, and the top European. So he is definitely one to watch at the European Championships, and certainly will challenge Pavel Maslak in that event as well.
I think it's interesting in the indoor season generally, because I find that you don't, unlike the outdoors where there's a lot of competition and a lot of build-up, you don't necessarily have to leave your own country before the championships, because February is just a crazy month for everybody, with like meets, trials, whatever, team selection, and then the first weekend in March, they normally have the championships. So like the likes of Carsten Vorholm has been able to just pluck away in Norway, training, doing the odd race, and then he can turn up to Glasgow, gold medal in his pocket after 2 days of competition, back to Norway and train for the outdoor season.
And the other thing we have to remember is that not every country has the same type of facilities or the same facilities available to everyone. So that also limits in how people are running. Some facilities are better than others, especially in an event like the 400 metres, where last year in Birmingham, of course, it was complete carnage with disqualifications and stuff, because people aren't used to certain tracks. If you have a non-bank track at home, or if you have a very steep track at home, you go to a different facility, mm-hmm. and it's completely different. And I think that's something that maybe where people that are only used to one track might struggle a bit more, as opposed to someone like Maslak, for example, who's just run probably on every indoor track there is and can just adapt to those. So I think that's one other interesting thing to bear in mind going into a championship.
It's not even a matter of being used to a track. Many countries don't even have indoor facilities.
Yeah, well, you know, you think about the likes of Australia. I mean, the indoor season to them is kind of like mind-boggling because most of them don't even know it really exists.
Well, we've just spoken to the two Australian 800 metre guys, Peter Boll and Joseph Deng, who...
This is their first season indoors,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, they both ran their first indoor races this year. Of course, Joseph Deng set a national record, not too much surprise, in Birmingham. They both kind of showed a bit of tiredness here.
They struggled a bit more, but that's just part of getting that consistency indoors.
Exactly.
It's such a different beast, really.
Yeah. But yeah, exciting nonetheless. But now I've completely thrown you, Ben, because you already want to move on and I just went on about the 400 metres.
So looking ahead in terms of indoor type stuff, we've got the NCAAs to look forward to in March. We've got the likes of Grant Holloway, Mondo Duplantis, all doing crazy things. Mondo did hold the world lead, I believe, in the men's pole vault for a while, but I think it got bettered by Sam Kendricks.
Yes, I mean, they've been, and that's the funny thing, because if you follow them all on social media, you might have seen, but they kind of constantly, even though they're not on the circuit together before competitions, they're all FaceTiming and they're all kind of calling each other out. And there's Pavel Wojciechowski FaceTiming Mondo with Sam in the background saying, oh yeah, you've just jumped that, but we're going to better that. And then they do, and then it keeps going back and forth. And it's really entertaining that although they're competing on different sides of the planet, they're still competing with each other.
Mm-hmm. So you did 88, okay, I'll do 89.
Yeah, and it's a nice little community in the men's pole vault at the moment. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what Mondo can jump at the NCAAs.
Absolutely, but you mentioned the man, Grant Holloway.
And
I just think he's going to win every event at NCAAs. Just throwing it out there.
He'd win every event at the World Indoors this year.
Probably. But if you look at the results he's had, he's currently number 2 in the world over 60 metres with 6.51. Number 12 in the world over 200 metres with 20.69. Number 1 in the world over 60 hurdles with 7.43. He's long jumped 8.02. He's run 3 4x4 races. I don't know his splits from those, but I did look up and he has clocked 43.88 outdoors in a relay split. So this just gives you an idea of what kind of range he has. And I think I also read somewhere that when he was 16 years old, he high jumped 2.16. So can we just enter him in an indoor pentathlon or heptathlon? Because
yeah, let's hope he can throw. but yes, and as well as the NCAAs, we also have the Euro Indoors. Is there anything specifically you guys are looking forward to there?
For me, women's pole vault again.
Yeah,
it's going to be
I think
really competitive.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's going to be really interesting seeing how that plays out, because it seems like a lot of the competitors have been around in the World Indoor Tour, so we've been able to see that kind of narrative develop, which has been cool.
And actually, do you know what? Women's long jump, Ivana Spanović jumped 6.92 yesterday in Belgrade. Of course, I mean,
Ivana.
That's for her her backyard, and she's jumped well there 2 years ago at the European Indoors, but it's just really good to see her back in such good shape after she, I think, ruptured her Achilles in Berlin last year. So it's really a substantial injury for a long jumper to sustain. And to come back and jump that well, I really hope she can lay down some big marks in Glasgow.
Last night also, Jacob Ingebrigtsen said he's not decided yet if he'll double.
Oh.
If he does, he'll be difficult to be.
Really?
What makes you think that, Rob?
Wild guess. I had a dream.
I think the double is possible in Glasgow. I think Laura Muir is doing the same thing on the women's side.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see whether Henrik will be competing, because he was due to compete in Dusseldorf, but he did pull out, didn't he? There. Last minute, was it an injury or?
I actually don't quite know. But I mean, on the other hand, there are a few of the middle distance events where I'm actually quite looking forward to, because just going back to the nature of the indoors, they're just so unpredictable.
Yeah.
There's always a bit of drama.
Klosterhalfen, we haven't spoken about her yet this indoor season. She's had a belter so far.
She has. She's been gutsy. Strong. I mean, the way she raced in Boston, the way she raced at the German National Championships, it's been just...
That was most impressive to me, the German National Champs. Watching her wind up the final 400 metres on her own, lapping runners. What did she run there? Was it 8.32? Or
thereabouts.
Yeah,
there
something
or thereabouts.
Like that. And I think she's going to give Laura Muir a run for her money. And Melissa Courtney as well, who also won the Karlsruhe World Indoor Tour meeting. So that, I think that'll be a good race.
I'm just, in general, I mean, I'm torn because I'm not going to be there this year. But I'm actually really looking forward to watching in front of the TV and being able to properly follow it, because you can actually see everything that's happening. When you're on site, you often miss one or two things, and then in hindsight, you kind of have to digest them retrospectively. And that's one thing I'm just going to be...
It will be nice to watch from home. I think one thing I did want to speak about, actually, I want to get you guys, both of your opinion on the Richard Kilty selection. For those of you who don't know, Richard Kilty actually didn't qualify for the British team for the European Indoor Championships because he did not have the qualification standards set by British Athletics. But he did have the qualification standards set by European Athletics, but you have to go by what your national federation the criteria that they set you. Unfortunately, he didn't fulfil that, meaning he was not listed in the British team. However, Michelle, I don't know, you read a tweet out yesterday from, it was
Sven Arne Hansen, the president of the European Federation, saying that they gave special permission for him to compete, and I think it's fair. Of course there's always problems with selection policies and it's down to the federations, but overall, personally, I think if you can fill the spots, you should fill them. And given he's won this title twice, mm-hmm. In World Championships, we often have actually wildcard spots for defending champions. So actually, I think it was a nice move and I think it'll make things a bit more interesting. What it means overall, I don't want to interpret into it, but I think it'll be good to see him because he has shown that he's been improving this season. He was obviously out with injury last year, so I think it's good that they made that move, and I think it'll be entertaining to watch regardless.
Has anything like this ever happened before where somebody like European Athletics has said, actually, no, we want a specific athlete to compete who wasn't listed in your team?
I don't know, but I don't know, but it's nice to see them make exceptions from time to time. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything really wrong with that.
Exactly.
No, I think it's cool of them too. So it'll be exciting to see how that plays out and whether he can get a third European indoor title. I think it all started with him at the World Indoors, right? He won that, then he won
Sopot. Yeah. Remember that famous image of him falling on the track and they called him the Angel of the North, of course, him being from up there.
Yeah, he's come a long way since then anyway. So yeah, best of luck to him. Coming up next is my chat with Lolo Jones. Lolo is a double World Indoor 60-metre hurdles champion, a Summer Olympian, a Winter Olympian, and has recently dipped her toes into the pool of reality TV. It's definitely fair to say she's an incredibly interesting and exciting person to chat to, and I hope you guys enjoy the interview. Especially before a holiday season, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought it was really interesting what you were saying earlier about the
adrenal glands.
Adrenaline stuff, yeah. Can you tell me a bit more about that again?
I don't want to talk about my tips to other athletes. They can figure it out, sorry.
Is that because I'm not a top-class athlete, so I'm allowed to know?
No, but I don't want other athletes knowing what I know. Like, they should do their research.
Has this always been a part of you as an athlete? You do a lot of research.
Yeah, always. You have to. I think the biggest step is learning how to just... I think it starts with making sure you're taking the right supplements and you're informed on that, because a lot of companies, you know, you have to make sure you're looking at the back of the labels and this and that. And so, and from there, you just learn more about your body. Like, what are the effects of certain foods that are, you know, certain foods do certain impacts on your body. And so... just making sure that you know and you're informed about everything, because for us, our body is like, most people go to work and they take a laptop and that's part of their equipment for their job. Mm-hmm. Well, our body is our equipment for our job, and it's like, you have to make sure everything's in check and everything is wanting to perform how you want it to perform. And if you're eating something or consuming something or doing something that could negatively affect your performance, you have to make sure that you have that in check.
Okay, what was your degree in?
Economics.
Economics, okay. You can kind of see that you're very systematic. On a slightly brighter note, with the sport and growing up, what first attracted you to track and field?
I like track and field it was more so just the running. Mm-hmm. I was a runner growing up and...
Sprinting?
No, I was a long distance.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was a distance runner and I just liked it, just being able to go out there and just get in the zone and push yourself mentally to see how far you could run and if you could beat your time. Mm-hmm. Quicker the next time you did that. So I started off as a distance runner, and then when I officially started running track and field, I ran. I don't know why this watch goes crazy on me. I need to like. When I officially started watching running track and field, I ran the mile, and then I also ran the mile, and then I did all the jumps, like high jump, long jump, and then the 4x4.
Oh wow, really? Yeah. Varied. Were you any good at any of them particularly?
Yeah, I was very good.
Really?
Especially in the distance run. I was a very good distance runner. And then the coach needed someone to do hurdles because none of the other girls wanted to do hurdles because they didn't want to fall. They didn't want to like get scars on their legs. And so I said I would do it, and then I did. I ran one hurdle race. I had no experience, and I won the whole year. So I just stayed with hurdles after that.
How old were you?
That was in middle school. I was in like 7th grade.
Oh my god, so pretty young then.
Yeah, and so then I just stayed with hurdles. So I still did like the other events, but they kind of just, you know, I realized what I was good at. Like, I was still a very good long jumper and high jumper, and then with the time scheduling, high jump and long jumper always at the beginning of a track meet, so it was getting too hard for me to end the mile, so I just, process of elimination, so.
Wow, the mile and the 100 meter hurdles is like, that's a crazy.
No, I never did the mile and the hurdles at the same time, so originally okay. I was doing the mile, high jump, and long jump. Well, okay. Those are all the first three events at a young track meet. Like,
okay.
If you're running in middle school or high school, those are usually like the first events, and I, like, to do a mile and then go do a jump, I was completely toast, so. Yeah. Got rid of the mile and then did high jump, long jump, and then the hurdles. So it was an easier schedule.
You're not far away from a heptathlon there.
I know. They always said I would make a good hept because I did. We actually, at college, we do a hept scoring system. So we do like an indoor pentathlon.
Mm-hmm.
And I always had like the highest scores and even better than some like a lot of the college athletes. So I would have made a good hept, but it's just, I, no.
Quite stressful on the body and the mind, I guess.
Yeah.
So were you always really sporty growing up?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love playing sports. Any sport, I would just, you know, really basketball or so, whatever it was, I just enjoyed just being active.
And were you a Louisiana native?
No, I grew up in Des Moines, Iowa.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And what was growing up like for you?
It's easy. Like, it's a very nice lifestyle. Like, they're focused on families there, so that's where Drake Relays is at, so... Mm-hmm. That's where I kind of just got my feel for track and field. They have one of the longest and oldest track and field competitions in America. And so yeah. When you have, as a kid in your backyard, you have mm-hmm. Michael Johnson and like Jesse Owens competed there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great competition. And I had that in Iowa, and most people, like even in Texas, didn't have that. So it was really yeah. cool to see that and get inspiration from that.
Oh, cool. So... You went to LSU,
mm-hmm.
Louisiana State, and that's a pretty iconic athletic university.
Yeah.
What made you decide to go there?
I went there because they were on a streak. They had won like 13 national titles, mm-hmm. and they were rebuilding their program. And they were just, I mean, if you know anything about track and field, you know LSU is one of the heavy hitters for track and field. You can't really go wrong. And I went there and we won nationals 3 out of the 4 years I was there. So, and what's very rare though is the fact that I'm still there, because mm-hmm. now that I've been a professional athlete for many, many years, most athletes at one point have to make a coaching shift or a location shift. And I've been able to train at the same place for years, and mm-hmm. I've been successful. I mean, not only have I made 3 Olympic teams, I've made them in 2 different sports. And having yeah. the ability to do that and not have to move has been really nice.
Have you stuck with the same coach?
The same coach.
And since you started at Louisiana State?
The same coach.
Wow, that's incredible.
And I started at LSU when I was in 2000, so I've been there for 18 years. That's
wow.
insane. Yeah.
So do you study still at all?
No, I mean, once I got my degree in economics mm-hmm. and... I just got way too busy, especially when I started doing the other sport. I had no off season. There was like 4 years where I didn't have an off season.
Yeah.
Like most track and field athletes would finish and then they would have a few months off. And those few months, that's when I would go into bobsled. So.
Yeah. So you graduated in 2005, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then pretty quickly you gained international success as a 100 meter hurdler.
I didn't feel like it was internet. It was quick. It was quick, as in I was able to do it in one cycle. I was able to do it in 4 years.
Yeah.
I went from not making an Olympic team my senior year when I graduated from college to the next year not only making the Olympic team but winning the Olympic trial. So
yeah.
I felt like it was not quick, but it was like, so like my first year pro, I was getting 5th through 8th place.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, I was getting like the second year pro, I was getting like 3rd through 5th. The second year before the Olympic trials, I was like top 3. And then the year of the Olympic trials, I was winning every race. So yeah. It was a very good...
Natural progression.
Yeah, it was a very good progression for me because it didn't feel like it was like bam, overnight.
Yeah, I mean, you went to the World Championships in 2007, Osaka. That was your first mm-hmm. World Champs, right? How was that for you?
For me, it was frustrating because, and it still happens where they have World Championships and Pan Ams, and so I had to give up a Pan Ams to compete at World Championships. And to this day, it was something I think about, and I kind of regret. I wish that we would time that out better so that the athletes wouldn't have to choose between a World Championships and a Pan Am Games.
Mm-hmm.
With that being my first international experience, it was very. It was just, there was a lot to learn, like the protocols, the multiple call rooms. We have call rooms for track and field, but not like they are on World Championship Olympic level. Waiting quite a bit. But I am glad that I had that 2007 experience, because that was my only experience before the 2000 Olympic Games. So had I not had that, I don't feel like I would have been as prepared to compete at the, Beijing Games.
Yeah. How did you find being in a completely different environment? Because it was in Osaka, Japan, which is kind of alien to what American culture might be like.
It was definitely, they were very tight on security, and just getting used to all the rules that come with, like, the representing Team USA, and like making sure there was, like, we had a security guard on every floor. And so, like I said, it prepared me for the Olympics and the security you have to go through entering the Olympic Village, mm-hmm. and exiting. So it was a very good experience in that regards. But until you really make a team, there's really nothing that kind of prepares you. Traveling in Europe can kind of somewhat, but like when we travel to the Diamond League competitions, it's kind of on your own.
Yeah.
Like, you're not with a team, you don't have team meetings, you don't have security protocols per se, you check into the hotel, you go in your room.
Mm-hmm.
So it prepares you a little bit, like with the bus schedules. But like I said, anytime you can make a team, it actually prepares you for the protocol that you'll go through, a mini protocol that
yeah.
you'll go through for the Olympic team.
And so 2008 was kind of your year, really. You started off with a bang at the World Indoor Championships. You won gold there. You're incredible indoors over 60 meter hurdles. How did you find that championship for you?
The indoor championships,
mm-hmm.
was great. Well, I got sick though. Actually, was 2008?
2008, you won, didn't you?
I won, but I got sick. I got sick. I'm trying to remember, because the championships are always a blur. None of them have been to.
Yeah, you ran 780.
I can't remember if that was a year. That was in Doha.
Doha, you ran really fast.
Yeah, but Valencia was. Yeah, so 2008 was when Susanna was still running.
Yeah.
So, and she actually, that's the year she broke the world record, if
yeah.
I remember right. So I actually wasn't supposed to win that race. I remember they had all pegged her to win because she had won she had broke the world record in Stuttgart like that year.
Mm-hmm.
And so oddly enough, and it happens to all, at one point in your career as a hurdler, you're going to hit a hurdle. It doesn't matter. If it's practice, whatever, it happens. And so... she actually hit a hurdle, I think, in that
yeah.
race. And so I ended up winning. And I remember it was just like, they asked me after the race, they said, would you have won that race if she was in it? And I was very honest. I was like, absolutely not. She just broke the world record.
Mm-hmm.
And so that just helped me just to realize, just how the hurdles are and how it can be. And so that's the one thing I love about the hurdles, is because you can be incredible,
yeah.
but you nick, you tap, you any one small thing in the hurdle race, and you can go from world record holder to not winning. And it's happened to me. It's happened to so many of my friends that I compete against.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's just, that's what makes it exciting and
yeah.
interesting. And so it's not like the 100 meters. Like, if someone's on a streak in the 100 meters, like, unless they pull their hamstring, they're
yeah.
pretty much going to win. But in the hurdles, though,
mm-hmm.
in the hurdles, it has a way of just equalizing the playing field. And, like, you look at Gail Deaver. She was one of the fastest women alive.
Yeah.
She won Olympic gold in the 100 meters. But she was never able to win a medal in the 100-meter hurdles.
And she called herself a hurdler.
Yeah, and she called herself a hurdler. And I know her as a hurdler. We all know her as a hurdler. Like, she had all the records at one point for the Americans, the American record holder. So it's just, the hurdles are tricky, and
mm-hmm.
that's what's great about them.
Yeah. I think that 2008 season, would you have considered yourself the world number one heading into the Olympics?
Yeah. I mean, I think I had the... I don't know what happened. Oh, Susanna got hurt, I think. No, she got hurt.
In the semis, was it?
Yeah, yeah. She got hurt. Well, going into the Olympics, I didn't really care what they ranked me. I think they had me ranked for number one, but I really didn't care. You know, I just was... I was laser focused, and I was just making sure that I stayed focused, head down, and just doing work, so, yeah.
And how did you find your, like, the velocity, the sheer size of the Olympic Games?
Well, that's nothing you can describe. It's insane, especially walking in the opening ceremonies and seeing everyone cheering for different countries. It's it's insane. So, I think World Championships is, like, it does, like, it's usually the same kind of stadium, you know?
Yeah.
It's the crowd... You know, it's going to be full for the men's 100 meters. It's going to be full at the World Championships, at the Olympics. So you get a feel for it at World Championships, like what the crowd size is. But you don't get a feel for is the fact that the whole world is now watching. Because now more people are watching on, you know, back home on TV as opposed to World Championships. We get people who are watching, but it's
not on the same scale.
Not on the same scale at all.
Yeah. And how did you find your first Olympic debut? So obviously... You won your semi-final.
Yeah.
And then going into that final, were you thinking about anybody else, or was it just you?
Well, actually, a lot of people don't know this, even to this day, I really didn't talk about it, but three days before, I had severe tooth pain, I didn't know what was going on, so I went into, they have a dental clinic in the Olympic Village for all the athletes, and so I just figured it was like a cavity or something small, and all they spoke was Chinese, so there was no one who spoke English, and they just started working on my mouth. Actually, and I didn't know until I left, but they gave me like a root canal before my Olympic. So I literally did not leave my room, my dorm room, for 48. Like, my coach was worried. So like my roommate had to bring me food, like soup and everything. And so, yeah. And so by the time I was able to kind of get out of the, you know, coma that I was in from having a root canal and not even knowing what the heck I had, my running schedule began. So I literally had no time to think about anything else. Like, literally, that was my first time having any, like, teeth problems or anything go on. And it happened, like, right before my first Olympic experience. So I didn't get to go out and do a lot of the things that other athletes did. Like, I didn't go see the Great Wall of China. I didn't walk around. I didn't tour. Like, literally, once that hit me,
you were done.
I was done. And, like, now they, like, I mean, I was the first, so, like, they put a protocol in place, and now they have, like, a rep that will go with the athlete to make sure that they're communicating before they, like, start any procedures. So that should have, like, kind of never happened, but it did, and so...
Yeah.
But for me, no, I didn't do anything. I didn't really get to experience what other athletes... They're like, yeah, I went to the Great Wall of China. I went to go do this. I went to they went to, like, the Silk Market and all this, and I'm like, I was in my room.
And how, obviously, the Olympic final, you were leading.
Yeah.
And do you think about that much anymore?
No, I mean, it's a learning lesson. I mean, I've had so many races, and I think everybody wants to go back to that. Like, you're going back to a race that was 10 years ago, and for me, it's just like, it's frustrating. Like, I feel like everyone kind of needs, like, I've processed that, and I find it interesting that people are still on that, but most of my fans are more inspired by the fact that I came back from that. I came back from spine surgery to compete in the 2012 Olympic Games. And it's like, I feel like with you guys or IAAF, everybody wants to bypass that and just talk about 2008. But I'm a 3-time Olympic athlete in 2 sports.
Yeah.
I broke the American record at one point. I mean, I've done a lot of things, even though I messed up in one race, but it's just like everybody wants to focus on that. If I hit a hurdle, I'm going to get back up. I'm going to fight. I'm going to, you know, make another way or get over it, because that's literally my job as a hurdler, is to get over something that's blocking my path. So I didn't get an Olympic gold. So then I go on and I compete in 2 more Olympic Games after that. And even to this day, I don't have an Olympic medal, but there's so many Olympic medalists. Like, not saying that and to be rude, but there are, I can't, can you count how many Olympic medalists there are? There's,
nope.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's, if you had to guess, there'd probably be, what, over 2,000 Olympic medalists?
What,
maybe
per
more?
Year?
No, in the history of the Olympics.
Oh, pretty more than that, yeah.
Well, there's 10 people that have competed in the summer and winter games, and I'm one of those 10. So
yeah, that's incredible.
I don't have an Olympic medal, but I know that I've overcome extreme odds, and I'm still, you know, doing that every day. And it's not so much for a medal, it's just for to show people, like, look, if you have something that's completely stopping your path and you're achieving something, like, fight for it, fight like hell for whatever it is, like, mm-hmm. don't, like, back down, don't get discouraged, don't quit, like, keep fighting until you literally have nothing left in your tank. Because at the end of the day, when you lay your head down and go to sleep, and you're, and you have those questions of, like, oh, why did I hit this hurdle? Or why did this not work out for me? Or why did I mess up? At the end of the day, when you want your peace, you have to know, I did everything I could to overcome something. And mm-hmm. so that's what I do. That's what I live by. That's my mantra, is just making sure that I do everything in my possible power to just overcome.
And so you spoke about it there with the competing at the Winter Olympics, which is a pretty crazy thing to have done, that you did both summer and winter.
Mm-hmm.
What made you just decide to go to the winter, or the bobsled specifically?
Well, after the 2012 Olympics,
which you did well at as well.
Yeah, well, I did well. What I mean, I got fourth by, like, I forget what the, it was a close race.
It was,
but
a route, yeah.
Yeah. And what was frustrating about that is, after I got fourth, the media and social media was, there was a lot of backlash, like, how could Lolo get fourth, you know, because for them it's hard as an athlete, because they only look at us every 4 years.
Yeah,
so for them they were like, oh, she was supposed to win in Beijing and she didn't win, and then she went to London and she got fourth, like, she keeps messing up. But they forgot all the years in between. And so for London 2012, a year before, I had spine surgery, so yeah, I couldn't even walk the year before the 2012 Olympics. And for me to even go from zero, ground zero, to get to not only be able to walk, but to run, and to be one of the fastest runners in the world, mm-hmm. in less than a year, for me, that was, I couldn't believe, I mean, to this day, it's like a miracle I made that team, and to go on to get fourth.
Would you say that's your biggest achievement?
Yeah, I think that was hard. That team was harder for me to make than my first team, absolutely. Yeah. Like, to this day, I just, the amount of mental and just toughness and grit it took me to make that team. I remember I went into the Olympic trials in London, and or for, you know, for the London Olympic, yeah, trials, and I had such a low or bad time. I had one of the slowest times to enter the meet, so I had to use my time from a year before to qualify for, yeah, the Olympic trials. Like, if I had used my time, I would have been like the last place girl. So I used my time from like 2 years ago to, like,
oh my
enter.
God.
Yeah, it was that bad. And I literally just, I remember I got third. I got third place in the first round, which is, if you know anything about our rounds, third place, you need to get third place in the last round to make the Olympic team. So that, yeah, means every round I literally was on the cutting edge. I got third in the second round, and then third. I was the last girl to make the final.
Really?
And then I made the Olympic team. And so, and then even when I went to London, I was the last girl to make. I remember in the semis, I didn't run so good. And me and Tiffany Porter of Philly were underneath the Olympic Stadium. Both of us had just run, and both of us were watching the score, the screen, to see who would go. It was either me or her. And literally, it was me. And she just broke down, and I had to regroup and get ready for the final.
It's weird because it was a home Olympics for her, I guess.
It was a home Olympics. And then what's crazy, even more to add on to this, is we had someone test positive in the final. So technically, she should have been in the final.
Yeah.
So I watched somebody literally cry because they did not make the Olympic final. And in all reality, she should have been in the Olympic final.
Yeah.
So it's, but yeah, so I was the last girl to make into the Olympic final, and then I got fourth. And so what made me go into bobsled is the fact that when I got fourth, and I got the incredible backlash for not getting a medal, and it was frustrating because that was the fastest Olympic final in history. To this day, it's the fastest Olympic final ever run.
Mm-hmm.
My time that I would have ran would have got me a medal in any other Olympic Games, even Rio.
Yeah.
So it was just frustrating. I felt like I did everything. I was like, man, I overcame spine surgery. I made the Olympic team, and then I still, in people's eyes, this is not good enough because I didn't get a medal. And so I just, it was the first time I didn't want to run track and field. I just like wanted to just, I didn't know if I wanted to quit, but I was just kind of just absolutely frustrated and disgusted with the reaction of people. And so I just wanted to be out of the limelight. I want to be out of the spotlight. So then that's when I decided to do bobsled, because I knew like it was such an unknown sport. They don't have cameras really at all their competitions. No one, they don't air them on, you know, no one knows anything about bobsled. So yeah. I knew I could just hide out. I could participate in a sport and just have fun and just see if I liked competing, mm-hmm. and not have to worry about, oh, that's Lolo Jones, you know, like 2-time world champion. Like I could just enjoy being an athlete again.
And how did you find that?
It was good. Like it was, I was able to actually do all that, and I was able to just, you know, it's completely different from track and field, and actually bobsled helped me to appreciate track more because it's different, you know, like especially when I come to Europe for track. You come to Europe, someone picks you up, they drive you to the hotel, mm-hmm. and you are in your room pretty quickly. Well, bobsled, you go to Europe, you wait for the whole team to get there, which could be hours. Then you drive your own car truck, go pick up the bobsled, which is 400 pounds. So it's very hard work. You get all the equipment for the bobsled, and then you may drive 2 to 4 hours to the competition. So it's a very hard lifestyle. It's like track and field.
You don't realize how good you got it.
Track and field is posh. It's luxury. It's like track and field is like you own a yacht. And then bobsled is like you're working a small fishing boat and you're doing all the work.
Oh my God. So are you, if I've got this right, you're no longer bobsledding.
No. I had too many concussions. That's the only downside of the sport. Yeah, I had 2 this year, and it was to the point where I was forgetting people's names and stuff. Oh, so it was really bad. So I was just like, as much as I like stepping away from track and field, it was just, it's a very dangerous sport at the end of the day. And
how do you get concussed?
Well, if the pilot crashes the bobsled,
right,
then the bobsled flips and it's just literally flipping down the, like it's going crazy on, it's like a car accident.
How terrifying.
Yeah, it's beyond. It depends on the track, but where I was crashed at was one of the most dangerous tracks in the world, Altenburg, mm-hmm. Germany. And so it's a very rough track to be crashed at. Yeah. So,
wow, that's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we've got 2 really big years coming up. Mm-hmm. You've got Doha.
Yeah.
And then we've got Tokyo.
Doha and Tokyo, yeah.
Is that all that you're thinking about right now?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, right now, I'm just happy that I can just train, because last year when I came back from bobsled,
mm-hmm.
I had one of the hardest injuries in my life. It was an Achilles injury, which every runner can relate to that. And at one point, I was like, I don't think that this thing is going to heal. I don't even know if I'll be able to even run anymore in my life. So mm-hmm. it was one of the hardest injuries to come back from. So it's taken a year. And so now I'm training. I'm doing everything with my group. And so for me, I'm just appreciating the fact that I have the ability to run, and I'm just going to, like I said, I'll just see how far my legs take me. So I know that it's, I actually like the fact that no one cares what I'm doing anymore. It's nice, but never overlook, like for me, Gail Devers has always been an inspiration, and she was running until she medaled when she was 38. It was 37 or 38, which mm-hmm. is insane.
Well, a lot of athletes do.
A lot of athletes do. It's just one hasn't done one recently. I mean, the last one I can think of was Felix Sanchez.
Yes.
And I remember, and that's my homie. And I remember what he went through, because I was with him for those cycles. So he won his Olympic medal. And then he went years where he kind of really didn't do anything. He was in the mix, but not really. And I remember how much backlash he as well was getting, how hard it was for him. He lost sponsors. But I'm glad I saw that, because he won his Olympic medal when he was 41 years old. Like, that's impressive. Gail Devers at 38. So it is possible, especially now with, you know, how much better the science is behind athletes on recovery and mm-hmm. how to maintain your body. But it hasn't been done in a while. So I just hope to just continue to inspire people. But now I'll be like on the other side of that. I'm not the young person anymore. It's like she's the vet. And so I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, you could join an illustrious group then, hopefully, if all goes to plan.
I like it. Bring it on. You know, on the start line when they say everybody's name, I like that. I will officially be the oldest hurdler as we compete, so I like that.
Do you? Cool. Yeah. Well, okay, well, best of luck.
I will be the oldest, but I look the youngest. Thank you.
Thank you for doing that, Lola. Yeah. That was great. Elsewhere, out of the indoors, we've had some 5 kilometer world records. Happened in Monaco, Sifan Hassan, obviously, because the woman can do everything. And then Julian Vanders, both of them setting 5 kilometer road world records. So there was a bit of confusion about what the world how they were world records, because people have run faster in the past and that kind of thing. So Bob, I believe you can explain this to us.
Well, the IAAF decided to add this as a world record event as of the beginning of January 2018. Obviously, performances from 2018 were going to be considered. I think initially they had set some standards for immediate ratification. I think it was 1310 for the men, 1445 for the women. Those weren't achieved last year, so then they kind of went down the performance list to see what the first world record would be. Those don't really matter anymore because we had some decent performances now. In Monaco, so pending ratification, everything there was in place to be ratified, so those will be the world records going forward.
What do you guys think about, for example, Julian Wonders? He's had a really phenomenal start to 2019.
Not just to 2019, he's been amazing last year as well. I just think he's entertaining to watch. He's one of the athletes, similar to the Robertson twins from New Zealand, who really completely relocated their lives to Africa, who feel that if they want to be the best in the world or run with the best in the world, they have to train with them as well. So he's out in Kenya training there, and clearly it's working for him. Not everyone adapts well to altitude training. Some people do better with it than others, but for him it's clearly working, and I like the fact that he's putting himself out there and he's really going for these records.
So he's living in Kenya full-time then?
He is.
That's
out in E10.
And let's not forget the world record connection there with Mr. Bram Som.
Oh, yeah.
Shout out to...
18 hours after pacing Samuel Tafara back on the start line in Monaco.
Yeah, Bram Som.
And he was who was leading the pack last night in the 1500.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I mean, he is just like clockwork. We were briefly speaking with his manager yesterday in the car to the meet, and we were just trying to work out how, do we have a number on how many records he's paced? Because that must be incredibly impressive.
He's the unsung hero of athletics, I think it's fair to say.
And I like, do you know what? I like the fact that you see athletes appreciating the role, like pacemakers, and the way they interact with them afterwards when they push them on, because it is a team effort in that sense.
Well, he's also very good at his job. Not every pacemaker is as good as he is.
Yeah, we
obvious.
See it all the time. People who pacemake for the first time.
It's not an easy job at all.
And I've spoken with him. We actually did a feature with him on Spikes a while ago, talking about the transition from racer to pacer. And he was talking about the fact that, yes, sometimes you go to a meet and the meet director comes to you and say, oh yeah, this pace has been requested. And then he says, what I always do is before the meet, speak with everyone in the race and just check and say, like, look, this is the pace that I've been given. Is this actually what you're all gunning for? Because there's no point in me going out in a ridiculous pace and none of you follows me, because then my whole role is senseless.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that also shows his experience and his understanding of the job of a rabbit. But quickly going back to last night, one thing I do also like was that in the women's 800, we didn't actually have a pacer, because there the tour win was decided in this particular race, and the race organisers thought, actually, we want this to be a championship-style race and leave it open. And I do like seeing that. When it actually matters, when it's not just about the times, to see athletes just raw racing against each other. And it was an entertaining race.
It was. Yeah. It was pretty quick, too.
Alemu
was pretty convincing, but she almost went on, dipped under 2 minutes. Yeah. So
the myth of if you have an unpaced race, it's going to be slow, doesn't hold up. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think generally, you know, those kind of where it's not pace and it's not just gun to tape, hell for leather type racing, they are generally kind of more interesting because it is there is a whole new dynamic of racing, which, you know, I know we are a sport of racing, but a lot of time on the circuit, there's not a lot of racing because it is just kind of seeing how fast you can run. But then, you know, and you do the racing at the champs. But yeah, it's nice to see that happen on the circuit sometimes. But yeah, any final thoughts, guys, before we shut this thing down?
I'm already really excited for the outdoors.
Yeah,
I've been
me too.
Indoors the whole time. I kind of, my nostrils are dry and everything.
Everybody's
Bring
getting
on the
ill.
Mud in Aarhus and
oh,
world
yeah.
relays. It's got to be such an exciting year.
Yeah, I'm really excited for the cross country. I think we'll be bringing you a preview of the Aarhus Cross Country Championships in a month's time. And that's going to be, yeah, super, super exciting. So I can't wait for that.
Are we running the mass race, guys? Are you all up for it?
I actually really want to, but I will fall over because that course is crazy.
And we're going to deliver a live commentary of Ben's race in Aarhus.
Oh,
video to follow.
Right.
Just one final thought on the World Indoor Tour. I was really happy to have crossed paths with both Juan Miguel Echeverria and Yulimar Rojas.
Oh yeah, wow. Rojas.
Obviously they were struggling with their rhythm. It was very inconsistent, but Echeverria has some monster fouls.
Mm-hmm.
And
is that the official term?
Monster fouls.
Monster fouls. MFs? No, maybe not. Maybe not. MFs.
So did Rojas as well, to be fair.
And Rojas had a really good jump in Madrid. She was struggling again yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it bodes well, really well as going towards Doha.
And she's just brilliant for the sport as well. Like yesterday in Dusseldorf, she did her event, and then in the second half, she was just sat in the crowd, and then the director of the feed or whatever kept on putting the camera on her, and she was dancing for everybody in the crowds.
Well, she's just, I think, exactly, she's one of those athletes who's just entertaining to watch. She loves putting on a show. She doesn't put it on. It's just her character. When you see her running around the hotel, she's just like that.
Exactly.
And I love that. And I think that, as you said, it's just fantastic having people like her around.
That is her, and it's infectious.
Yeah.
You can't help but smile when you're next to her.
I mean, we always dance around her.
Okay, well, thank you for joining me, guys. Where can the lovely people find you on social media?
At Michelle Samet, everywhere.
At Bob Ramsack, most places.
And I'm at _BenHarlow, only on Twitter. thank you for listening to this this month's episode. We'll be back again towards the end of March with the World Cross Country Championship preview. And yeah, we hope you all have a wonderful month's worth of enjoying athletics, really. So yeah, see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Gonna miss you.
Please leave that in.
I definitely am.